Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our explorations of the cultures of consciousness, and a reminder that the archive, the now not exactly vast, but let's say healthy archive for Expanding Mind is available both on PRN-FM as well as my own website, www.technosiswithag.com. So you can dig through them. There's a lot there. And today what's been on my mind are as the models of the cosmos. I was thinking about one of the interesting things about cosmology is that for all the different ways that we might think of the world, different people, different philosophies, different political system, different balances of science and religion, rationality and mystery, that nearly all, at least educated people, have a vision in their head of what the cosmos actually looks like to some degree. We know where there's a sun, we're on a planet, we're floating around the sun is spinning around this galaxy, the galaxy is only one of billions of galaxies, and we have some basic sense or basic affirmation that that is the case. And it's kind of an interesting thing that that even people who have very different religious views and views of alternate realms of reality, we all kind of settle on a loosely defined sense of what this cosmos really is. And yet that model is, of course, a model. It's based on information, on scientific visualization, on cultural stories, on newspapers, on scientific metaphors. And, of course, the idea of billions of galaxies itself is pretty new, that a mere 100 years ago, you know, a single century, couple generations, almost everybody was thinking in terms of a single Milky Way galaxy. And only some weird smudges seem to indicate that perhaps there were a few other galaxies out there. And so it's really been, just in the last 100 years, a remarkable mind-expanding, mind-challenging change in our models of the cosmos. And it's really key to kind of tune into the way in which we use media, we use images, we use visual art in order to play with and kind of install the sense of new models of the cosmos. I remember when I first saw the film Contact, the Jodie Foster mixed bag film, worth seeing, some great stuff, some cheesy Hollywood bits as well. But for those who have seen the film, you remember at the very beginning, there's this extraordinary pullback from Earth. We start hurtling away from the planet. We go through the solar system. We go through the layers of the radio emissions that we began in the early 20th century as you hear older and older radio speeches, and then we're outside and we keep taking these steps back, these enormous cosmic step backs, until we wind up with a reasonably accurate model of the large scale structure of the entire universe. And it's quite a ride, quite a trip. And I've done another version of that at the Natural History Museum in New York City. A famous model by Carter Emart, a 3D atlas of the universe that does a similar but much more rigorous view. And one time we were there one evening after a wedding festival, and I was able to get on the controls myself, and it was really quite a giddy and uncanny sense of being both above a model and within a model. And that tension is really key to our sense of our place in the cosmos. We're both within it, and yet we are able in some sense to create models that seem to put us outside of it. And there's always this rich tension between the two as we try to find out where we are, where we think from, where we observe from, where we live and breathe. And to help us shed some light on this most interesting liminal zone, we're going to be talking today to David McConville. I know David mostly through his work as an immersive media designer, who very interested in the history, as we'll talk about, and phenomenology of different media representations of the cosmos. He also recently got a PhD in art and media from the Planetary Collegium, which is a very interesting outfit that brings together artistic and media and philosophical and big picture consciousness thoughts, and creating some very interesting zones in an often rather shut down academy. And finally, David is also the chairman of the Bucky Fuller Institute. A couple of months ago, we talked to Jonathan Keats about his new book on Buckminster Fuller, and Dave McConville is an even more enthusiastic Bucky Fuller guy, and the Bucky Fuller Institute does some really amazing stuff in terms of drawing proposals that are really challenging designers, architects, ecologists, artists to come up with really innovative big picture thinking in the Bucky Fuller spirit to address ecological problems, environmental problems, architectural problems, et cetera, et cetera. It's very worthwhile to go look at the winners of their, and even just the people who contribute to their program because of the really exciting range of thoughts, ideas, practices, and technologies that are brought to bear on the agonizing conundrum of our contemporary world experience. So with no further ado, David, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Good morning. Thank you, Eric.
Yeah. Hey, so why don't you start off with maybe a little personal story about when you first really kind of grokked the consequences, the possibilities, and in some ways the real kind of central importance that models of the cosmos, whether they're a planetarium show or an ancient Ptolemaic design on a parchment paper, or you know, an image in a film, when these models, how these models of the cosmos really kind of center us and become a site of artistic and intellectual work. When were you first turned on by that kind of cosmic model?
How far back do you go? I mean, I think, you know, I wonder, a lot of us in childhood, you know, we had memories of these kind of overarching sort of existential questions. And I remember looking at the filaments of light bulbs turning on and off when I was young, just imagining like sort of the creation and the destruction of everything. And I think in many ways, you know, we go through life sort of constructing our own at least tacit vision of sort of what this larger structure is. But it wasn't really until after being involved with immersive visualization environments, particularly domes in the 1990s, that I was participating in the design of a museum that never got built, actually, but it was a museum of world mythology. And we were being asked to think about how to help kind of Middle America relate to Incan archaeoastronomy. And so I was working with an archaeoastronomer as well as the son of Alan Watts, sort of considering, you know, how do you create visualization environments that really immerse audiences within kind of a first-person perspective to think about why certain structures were designed in the way that they were, so that they would align with certain stars, and what was the significance of that, and why did that even matter in the context of the knowledge spaces for those cultures. And I really didn't have that much of a background in the history of science or science and technology studies or anything like that. I was mostly coming from audio engineering and a lot of kind of visual arts. And so it was fascinating to me when I stumbled upon this idea of knowledge spaces. It was particularly a book by David Turnbull called Mason Strixers and Cartographers that really sort of opened up this world to thinking about the different ways in which we're constructing realities. And as we started really working through how to visualize these particular understandings and how, you know, we're kind of making sense of this big picture, I got increasingly interested in the contemporary attempts to do that. And I'd known some folks at the Hayden Planetarium, including Carter, who you just mentioned, and the work that they were doing with the Digital Universe Atlas. So I was really intrigued with all of that. And I'd also done some work in Japan with an artist named Mariko Mori, who was doing some kind of Zen Buddhist-inspired immersive visualizations in the late 90s. And so all of that sort of came together to cultivate a an inquiry into the nature of like how our attempts to model things are actually shaping the way we think about those things. And
you know, it's funny when you were talking at the beginning about going back to being a kid and looking at the light filament. It reminded me something that it's one of those wonderful things where I often forget and then I remember it again, and it really brings me a smile. So when I was a little kid, I would sort of do like a thought experiment version of this cosmological fallback, where I would sit there in my bed and kind of look up into the dark, you know, darkness of the room, and imagine that like beyond that, like that the universe never stopped, like this idea of infinity. And I would kind of like, and I can't really do it anymore because I have these congealed adult models in my head that sort of prevent the existential rush that I would get as a kid when I would go, the universe doesn't end. And then the contradiction of that, the impossibility of this thing that doesn't end, or if it ended, there would be something beyond it, which sounds kind of trite in a way, but at that time was actually incredibly lively. I mean, it was almost having a transcendental experience with a sort of, you know, thought experiment. And I really think that that's part of the key of these things, you know, because you're talking about modeling here, not just in a scientific context, but you're talking about in an artistic context, someone with Mariko Mori, who's also interested in different cosmologies and consciousness, and then also just the whole sort of return of the dome in the 1990s, at least in my experience, I'm not sure about yours, but in my experience was also bound up with the chill out tents and the sort of, you know, kind of percolation of new cosmological consciousness ideas coming out of the rave scene, which was really interested in new media representations of the cosmos, creating immersive environments, was all part of this kind of mix. So it reminds me, I'm sure you agree from hearing your talks and such, that one of the wonderful things about studying these models of the cosmos is that they combine this sort of, you know, a scientific, rational view of how we can really structure or represent these relationships in space-time. And there's always this kind of cosmological dimension too, a more mythological dimension, a sort of opening to this sort of existential sense of where we are and how we find ourselves in the world. And the combination of those two things is really quite extraordinary, and I think felt by a lot of people, the sense of the cosmic, we might call it.
That's kind of uncanny you mentioned that, actually, because I used to do the exact same thing, lying in bed, sort of having this existential rush, imagining, you know, the expansiveness of space-time. And I wonder if we did a survey of kids, like how many kids are sitting around the world right now sort of just defaulting to that. And I mean, strangely, like, I don't know how I quite, because I wasn't, you know, within a scientifically, you know, educated family per se, and I, you know, actually raised a very religious household in the American South. And so I didn't have a lot of exposure to things, but somehow I intuited as a kid the entanglement of space and time. And I was thinking about like going back further and further and further in time, the further I went out. And I just, you know, I've always wondered just where these memories come from, you know, like the degree to which when we come into this world, we're somehow carrying some deep intuition about the nature of the weirdness of it all. And, you know, and that's kind of the, you know, the before, as Fuller would say, before we were de-genius, before we were entrained to think about things in a certain way, that we could really get high on just those types of imaginaries and just allowing ourselves to explore, you know, what that really is. And maybe that's directly connected to, you know, why so many of us were involved in this kind of resurgence of media tools and virtual reality and everything in the 1990s. Because it was really reopening that space. You know, I know that that's how I re-entered into a lot of it, was through an interest in kind of immersive media and VR, and the domes definitely kind of coming out of the reappearance of geodesics on the festival scene, but also they became more of a sort of collective space for these spherical immersive environments that were really limiting within the head-mounted display realms that were, you know, being explored in the early 90s, that of course now are sort of back in full force like never before. And, you know, so it seems like those types of explorations and those types of, you know, abilities to tap into that just sheer overwhelming awe of really just even trying to conceive of or contain that spaciousness is part of what the attraction is to the sheer hubris of even trying to develop cosmic models. You know, there's something very, very tantalizing about the fact that our imaginations can do that and that we can even conceptually begin to wrap our minds around that.
Yeah, you have a really nifty talk called Valorizing the Sphere that you gave at the Society for Arts and Technology. And one of the things, I learned a number of things from that I had never really thought of, and, you know, real perspective openers or changers. And one of them is I had never really considered when we talk about the dome and maybe the return of the dome or the return of the sphere as part of a contemporary model of the cosmos. I never really thought about how, if you look historically, and we don't have to go into all the details, but if you look at the ancient model of the universe, I guess you could call it, has, you know, the Earth at the center, and then these concentric spheres that go up upon which the planets move, and then ultimately you get the big sphere of the heavens and the fixed stars, and that this was, you know, not just a little useful device that geeks would use. This was the world within which people lived. This was where religion sat, where the gods sat, where the soul moved, and that while this model changed, and changed quite significantly with the Copernican Revolution, there was still the sense that we were kind of inside this nested series of spheres. And then, in some ways, one of the symptoms of the shift to modernity, the shift to this weird modern feedback world of science and globalism and new models, new challenges, a kind of post-religious switch of our world building, in a way you can sort of show how that's linked directly to the destruction of the spherical model of the universe, and when we suddenly recognize that we're in this kind of infinity. Exactly what kind of infinity is a complicated question, but we're in something that is not a sphere, at least in any conventional sense at all, and that this is a really significant shift. That, you know, we can come back to the sphere in the modern world in a second, but I'd like to stay with that shift that happens, you know, in the early modern period. And you talk about the way that we lost, this is your phrase, the immune system of spheres. Could you talk a little bit about that a sense of the sphere as a kind of immune system that at some point we lose in our model of the cosmos?
Absolutely, and actually, that term was coined by Peter Sloterdijk, the German philosopher. He has a trilogy about the spheres that I discovered halfway through my own research. So it was particularly interesting because I thought I was on some sort of unique tangent, and as usual, sort of resonant philosophies begin appearing. And the way in which he describes it is, you know, that it creates this kind of comforting container that allows us to account for this overarching structure. And one of the real consequences of what happened on really the dissolution of those spheres within the European imagination that I really tried to look at was what did that really imply with regards to how we understood where we are and how we understood the heavens and how we understood Earth and sort of this binary division that used to be, I think, very, you know, very central to the ways of thinking about heaven and earth, at least within the context of Western philosophy and the ways in which, you know, Aristotle was kind of thinking about earth as feminine and corrupt and the heavens as kind of masculine and perfect. And that what began to happen was as the metaphors began to shift, particularly with regards to some of the ideas around this paradoxical notion of that was first used sort of in Hermetic lore of God being, you know, the center being everywhere and the circumference being nowhere, and that being a metaphor for God, that Nicholas of Cusa later transferred that into a metaphor for the universe. So that really started to destabilize these sort of relativistic sensibilities that was really central in terms of those metaphorical shifts that enabled Nicholas Copernicus, I think, to begin to push these imaginations of how it is we're thinking about our relationship to all of these other moving bodies that really started to destabilize the sense of this very, very stable universe, of this kind of predictable container of the heavens that we could look forward to, you know, transcending into when we die. And that as a consequence, really, it was extremely significant. I don't think it was just a consequence of modernity. It was really, I think, one of the seeded conditions of it, whereby, you know, whereby we really started to see this dissolution of the distinction between heaven and earth. And that idea of what's now called the Copernican principle and the mediocrity principle was that as the laws of, you know, celestial mechanics were discovered, and, you know, explorations in chemistry and physics, the idea that this place is just like everywhere else. And that was, I think, you know, far more traumatic than just the idea that Earth isn't at the center. That in many ways, it wasn't, as is often said, it wasn't Earth that was dethroned or humanity that was dethroned from being at the center, because it was actually thought to be kind of the worst place to be. You know, hell at the center with Dante, of course, but that heaven itself disappeared. And so that was really, you know, what sort of catalyzed, as you're referring to, this kind of post-religious, you know, angst that Nietzsche's Madman was referring to when he said, you know, God is dead, and, you know, who gave us the right to wipe away the horizon? And
totally agree with you. It's actually kind of interesting, I think about how widespread that incorrect idea is, the idea that in shifting to the Copernican model, we dethrone the egoistic centrality of Earth and human beings, which is how a lot of historians of science or just contemporary thinkers phrase that shift, when in fact it was something very different, because as you said, the Earth was not the great place to be. It was the bottom of rung of the ladder. It was the pit, essentially, and it was the higher spheres where all the action lay. And so it's almost like we can't quite see what the real consequences of that shift were as we entered into, you know, a modern world where things were destabilized but also made more equivalent. And then the other thing that happens when we lose the heavenly spheres and suddenly all we have are just vectors in something like space-time, although they don't think of it as such, obviously. But more or less, you just kind of keep going and you get that horror of the voids that Pascal talks about, the sense that there's just this great void around us and that we're just sort of spinning free. And is it a very modern sense, a disturbing kind of uncanny sense? But there's something else that happens, too, that in a way sets up the return to the dome in the 20th century, which is that there's some lingering aura of the heaven or the sacred that infuses this new void. And that's the sense of the sublime. That's the sense that the very immensity of this great void and all of the world spinning through it unknown to us has some kind of majesty to it, some kind of awesome marvelousness that we sense in our, you know, in our hearts, in our poetic selves, you know, out in the desert in a night sky without the moon, or you know, in other kind of forms of encountering the sublime in nature. And so that becomes a way, emotionally and aesthetically, that we kind of fill in or re-engage this weirdly emptied cosmos that we find ourselves in. It's like almost a race between disenchantment and a new kind of enchantment, which in my mind really goes into the kind of move that you make in your talk and in your research into understanding in a really deep way what's going on with all these planetaria and all these domes and all these the attraction of the dome in the 20th century as a new media of the cosmos.
Absolutely, and I think that you use the key word, which I know you've written about in other places, but the notion of disenchantment and reenchantment, you know, and the degree to which we encounter that sense of the sublime, and we have these other capacities, these sort of pre-conceptual, pre-linguistic experiences of just the uncanniness of everything, and that the degree to which that disenchantment or that reenchantment can be taken literally in terms of to sing, you know, enchanté, that Remy Brog at least writes about how with Plato in particular, you know, it was one of the first times that humans no longer had an active role in participating in the creation of the world, that we began to, you know, imagine through what he was writing about in Timaeus of seeing the world from the outside, seeing the cosmos from the outside, from this kind of transcendent perspective of the demiurge, of the creator, and the degree to which we no longer feel ourselves as having the responsibility or even the agency to be active participants in the creation of the world has everything to do with, I think, all of the follow-on consequences of how it is we've been imagining these transcendent views from the, you know, outside of everything. This central mythology of what we call modern science, of having these purely objective views and being able to, you know, as you were pointing out in the introduction, these kind of paradoxical aspects of us being in the center of our life world, but at the same time having the imaginative capacity to try to think of ourselves as being completely removed from it. And perhaps this is, you know, what was really happening with a lot of the Romanticism in the 19th century you're referring to, and in the 20th century with the attraction of a lot of these immersive spaces and sort of the reemergence of a lot of these kind of celebratory, you know, festival types of atmospheres, is the recognition of the necessity of us actually taking responsibility for the fact that we're so entangled with the world that we actually do participate in its emergence, that we do have a responsibility for the way in which we are really engaging in singing it into existence in whatever form that might come.
No, I love this. I want to stay with this idea that the part of what we see with culture, with poetry, with festivals, with particularly the immersive or kind of enchanting side of media is an attempt to kind of balance the sort of disenchanted experience of the world as a place that we can only approach in a kind of detached, quote-unquote, objective view, which is itself a sort of residue of a transcendentalist view that's looking down on the earth. It's kind of this urge that or desire to kind of balance things out. But what makes the cosmology stuff different is that a lot of that romanticism, that desire for immersive experience, for re-enchantment, a lot of it gets kind of derailed into escapism or, you know, pleasure, entertainment. It's fine, you know, but it becomes kind of a little bit dumb, in at least in many expressions. Yeah. And what's interesting about this cosmology stuff, if you take like Carter's wonderful model of the universe, is that it provides all that juicy, immersive experience, and yet it's linked to knowledge structures, information structures that emerge from that objective, scientistic kind of point of view. So there's kind of a sweet spot there that I feel like your work is kind of driving towards, where it's not just about the recovery of the mythological or the enchanted, but it's a way of bringing that into dialogue with our knowledge, with our more objective or more scientific knowledge, in a way to affirm that we're here, that we're in this system. We're moving forward as it's hurtling forward. We're not just detached observers or alienated intellects.
Absolutely, very well said. And I think that the challenge that we face is, how do we account for all of that? You know, that those multiplicity of perspectives. I mean, you know, this is a question that's been asked deeply in many philosophical circles, trying to develop meta theories and try to, you know, not just critique the God's eye view and the pure objectivity of, you know, the presumed objectivity of science or scientism, but also to integrate it, to, as you know, Wilbur said, to transcend and include it, but to also look at all of these other perspectives. And this was really what the heart of my own research was, after seeing Carter give one of the same tours in a project we did at Burning Man in 2004, and I was looking at the complexity of this data set, and I was really, really curious, how do you talk about something like that? Because there's a certain absurdity that comes about of just trying to describe these models in any purely subjective or purely objective way, that they're these kind of complex constructions that emerge from all kinds of cultural assumptions, from kind of situated observational limitations of trying to observe things through, you know, light measurements and taking into account the speed of light, but also from the perspective of just even understanding that from an ecological perspective, we're even here to be self-conscious, that we could even do that. And so that all of these things were really bubbling up inside of me when I was looking at Carter give the tour of this model. And it was really sort of instigating this desire to inquire into how do we really start to come up with a logic of complexity. So it's not just about the simplistic dualisms of subjectivity and objectivity, but able to really embrace and account for the dynamic complexity of the world that we're living in. And how can we even begin to sort of look at everything in that way, so that we have sort of a more nuanced foundation from which not just to try to be critical, but also to really embrace our own, you know, position as having the cognitive capacity to even imagine all of these kind of complex structures and our own efforts to make sense of everything.
Yeah, I mean, here's where, in my sense, like Bucky Fuller comes in a little bit, is that one of the operating assumptions or kind of gambits that you're making is that we can still, there's still a lot in the modeling either of a planetary system or of a cosmological system as a way of beginning to deal with that complexity, those multiple perspectives, because that's kind of part of the problem. It's like, okay, we have all these multiple perspectives. Obviously, we need an interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary approach. But, you know, that's overwhelming. One could barely keep up with one or two fields if you want to be really rigorous about it. So we need something to start to play with that interdisciplinary space. Why not come up with a new critical but also engaged way of modeling the very complexity that we're talking about in terms of the planet, its flows, its surfaces, its relationships, or in terms of the larger cosmos. So could you like kind of hone in on that a little bit, in the sense of what do these models still hold for us now, and as we attempt to deal with all this complexity, what keeps them from just getting in the way or just being another isolated perspective? What's the promise that these models can, or an example of the way in which these models can help us integrate different, radically different perspectives?
Well, just from a practical perspective, you know, the ability for us to create models is, you know, it's a feedback loop. I mean, that it gives us something to push against. And Fuller referred to it as a return to modelability. And he actually claimed that kind of with, you know, C.P. Snow's kind of famous phrasing of the chasm between the sciences and humanities, that with returning to modelability, he had discovered a way to bridge that chasm. And he actually claimed that C.P. Snow acknowledged that that was indeed the case, because Fuller was claiming that though oftentimes it's said that that chasm was really created by the humanities just not, you know, getting up to speed enough on the science and kind of not, you know, being rigorous enough to understand the advances in science, Fuller sort of flipped it on its head. And he said that in the 19th century, with the discovery of the electromagnetic spectrum, that the capacity for modelability was kind of out the window, that mathematics and science became increasingly abstract and they basically lost people. And so it created these so-called two cultures that are today still the sort of dominant element of why we see interdisciplinarity or transdisciplinarity as being so difficult, because there are such radically different language bases and there's such a radical fragmentation of knowledge. And so one of the things that Fuller was trying to do, was to return to modelability, to really understand the degree to which we can start to create really, really basic models to understand structure and form and to, as he would say, you know, mechanically apply philosophy to see how the world pushes back, how reality pushes back beyond just the pure, you know, abstractions of theory, but to apply those in the real world, which is really at the heart of so much of what he was doing. So in a lot of ways, where he ended up, and I don't think this was anticipated necessarily at the beginning of his experiment that I know, you know, you'd covered with with Jonathan on the previous show, but this, you know, half century long experiment that he did to see where it would go if he started with that idea of modelability, you know, where he really ended up was an extraordinarily cosmological place. He was reimagining himself back at the center of the sphere, and not only that, but came up with these, you know, the particular types of geometric forms that have since been discovered as being very, very fundamental within the manifestations of the technologies that we call nature. And so the ability that I found and the advantage that I found of actually working with these virtual models like the Digital Universe Atlas is it gives something to push back against. You know, it's not just purely speculating, oh, well, here's a model that I created because this is what I think the universe looks like. It's like, it's actually, no, it's a back of the napkin sketch about $10 billion worth of data and observations and, you know, massive infrastructures all over the planet that are doing the best they can scientifically to map and measure what we're observing out in the cosmos. And as you can play with that and you can start to move through that, you can really start to look at the complexity of what that process entails, that it gives you something very, very tangible to begin to address and explore, particularly with other people. That within immersive environments, as we're, you know, flying around these spaces, it's really an extraordinary provocation of why is it that things are modeled the way they are? Who selected what colors they are? Why are things positioned in certain ways? Why are we using a Cartesian coordinate system? That it's just an extraordinarily practical way to engage in dialogues and discourses that would otherwise be extremely abstract and difficult for non-specialists to comprehend.
No, I think that's really, really wonderfully said, and it reminds me also of one thing I've been thinking a lot lately, which, you know, it's not an uncommon thought, but one of my disappointments with how science is currently functioning, kind of in the mass media or in the way in which scientific news gets reported, or how people sort of imagine the scientific information coming into their lives, is that there's this great naivete about, and also a little bit of a spin on the science side with how models function. So, for example, if we, you know, those beautiful multicolored images of exploding galaxies that NASA will hand down to us on occasion, you know, are of course highly constructed objects that take in very abstract forms of data and find all sorts of ways to translate that into visually arresting and to some degree informative ways of modeling this information. But the way in which they get spread about, it's like the way in which the model itself is just a move in an ongoing game of negotiation with nature and with our own concepts gets erased. And so it's just this, here's this new thing. Look, the brain lights up. And you're like, great, it's a brain lighting up. And it doesn't mean that the models aren't useful, because that's the other side. It's like, oh, this is just a pablum. It just gets in the way. Only the real scientists who can actually understand the numbers are really going to be able to deal with it. This is just kind of a publicity thing. And that's not right either. And it seems like we're getting there, but we still have a ways to go in terms of engaging the richness of the models so that it can do this intellectual work, but also come with sort of, you know, scare quotes around it. Remember, guys, this is just a model. Let's iterate. Let's keep it going. I mean, I know these are concerns of yours, but I'd like to hear you talk a little bit about what you would like to see happen, or what you think you're seeing happening in a positive sense in terms of the ways that, let's say, our new immersive technologies or the oncoming of real deal virtual reality or other kinds of media immersive environments, how we're starting to move towards these kinds of rich, open-ended but still rigorous models of global and you know, cosmological conditions.
Well, I think the opportunity is to do exactly what you're suggesting. You know, I mean, that in the context of education, for instance, you know, the holy grail is kind of metacognition. It's the process of learning about learning and thinking about thinking. And what these models provide and what these tools can really provide is a way for us to understand how the process of modeling actually occurs. And coming from a perspective of someone who really had very minimal training in science, you know, other than the science of perception, when I first heard presentations, for instance, by Donna Cox, who was one of the artists that worked with the American Museum of Natural History on developing the Digital Universe Atlas, she was presenting at a SIGGRAPH conference, I think this was 1999 or so, and was talking about she was selecting those colors. You know, she's the one that does a lot of those kind of famous images that you're talking about with her team at the Electronic Visualization Lab. And she was saying how much it annoys scientists sometimes when she's talking about that, her own aesthetic decisions, the role that her own agency plays into singing the world into existence, you know? So in a sense, it's like she was the artist re-enchanting things that are designed to really provoke the type of reactions that you're talking about. And I find that instead of just trying to sweep that under the rug, the utility of these tools is to really dive into that, to lean into that, to understand, well, what does that mean that we have the capacity to be modeling and creating these worlds, that we're actually constantly in the process of world building? And in order to do that, let's develop as many tools as possible so that we can understand all of the complex parameters that go into creating something like that. I mean, and this is what hooked me. So I'm kind of in a sense my own guinea pig too. I'm looking at like, wow, when I found out about this stuff, my mind was blown and I just wanted to find out more. And I find that after going around for many years with these inflatable, you know, blow up domes that I invite people to come in for a tour of the universe, that by the end of it, we're having these, you know, conversations about philosophy and ontology and cosmology and the history of thought and humans being the universe becoming aware of itself. Like, all of these things can be provoked by really trying to find ways of thinking about our own thinking, by really taking that more metacognitive stance so that there's not just this suspension of disbelief, but it's what I like to call the suspension of belief, that the whole notion of going into immersive environments and thinking about how it is we create, you know, better kind of entertainment products is really predicated on that idea that Samuel Taylor Coleridge introduced in the 19th century of suspending our disbelief. And he said in order to do that, you had to have what he called poetic faith, right? And so when you go into an immersive experience, you go into a movie and you're just kind of like dropping any kind type of, you know, criticality, that you're suspending that disbelief. But if we really enter into it from another perspective, it opens up an entirely new realm of opportunities that I think are what these tools are really, really good for.
No, I think that's really wonderfully said, and it reminds me, it's a slightly tricky thought, but it feels like, you know, there's this tension between the sort of non-critical, immersive, poetic experience and then the critical, either scientific or sort of more whatever philosophically critical view that's suspicious of that kind of immersion, suspicious of that kind of joy or that kind of sense of awe or those kinds of aesthetic questions. It almost feels like, I mean, you can't just say we got to merge these two because I don't know what that means, but I think that we can bring them more and more tight. They can become more and more tightly coupled so that in experience, there is this sort of space of metacognition or of criticality, and simultaneously within critical thought, there's this kind of always this sort of ambient memory that we're always still constructing, that we're always still part of the poesis of the whole thing, even if at that moment we're performing as critical thinkers. And it's something that I get really frustrated with in a way, both sides of the equation. You know, I get tired of the kind of lack of criticality amongst immersive folks and vice versa. How many intellectuals, critics, scientists remain really naive about the ways in which they already are part of a poetic universe and that there's no way out in some sense. So we might as well do it well. And it seems like the experience of the dome, again, can kind of encourage that. But since you brought it up, and maybe a lot of listeners don't know, could you talk a little bit about what the sort of traveling roadshow was for so long and whether you're still doing that?
Sure. I founded a company back in 2003 with an optical engineer, and we were developing hardware and software, like fisheye lenses we would put on projectors and inflatable domes that would allow us to kind of rapidly set up these immersive spaces. And it was really in one of our first projects was doing this Museum of World Mythology and this project at Burning Man with Carter. And so that sort of evolved into the use of this immersive space with that kind of powers of 10 influenced visualization of the Digital Universe Atlas. And that became a practice that I had for many years, where I was basically going around performing to as many and as varied audiences as possible to explore that question of, like, how do you talk about that model? And so that really became a central part of the research that I was doing for my dissertation, was looking at it as a performative practice, really, and a kind of a practice-based research project to see if I'm trying to lead people through, you know, this virtual cosmic tour from the surface of the Earth out to the cosmic microwave background and back for an hour. How do you talk about that? How do you account for all of that complexity? How do you really try to cultivate a kind of metacognitive understanding of all of that? And so I was fortunate enough to be able to do that for many years to an incredibly wide range of with an incredibly wide range of participants, including people from different knowledge traditions, different religions, people that would have their own type of, you know, rituals that I would participate in and then invite them to come and, you know, sit in the dome to do what I was calling cosmotroping at the time. And I was also living in North Carolina, so I got to do this with a lot of people that weren't necessarily, you know, from the festival circuit or, you know, people that were familiar with a lot of these tools and technologies. And so it became a very practical pursuit in some ways of how can you engage sort of the deeply inquisitive part of anyone in the process of looking at how it is we're trying to make sense of the universe. And so I wasn't just looking at the contemporary Digital Universe Atlas, I was also incorporating sort of the history of Western cosmology into these presentations, looking at, you know, the cave paintings up to, you know, ancient Greek models to the Scientific Revolution, and really trying to narrate a story of how our conceptions of these cosmic models have evolved over time and the ways in which they're really influencing the way that we think as we try to model it. So it's the whole idea that as we are working on actually creating the models themselves are influencing the way that we think. And so within this immersive space, it was possible to really explore that from many, many different perspectives and many, many different routes over the number of years that I was doing it. And I'm still doing it occasionally, and actually ended up doing a project funded by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration with science centers all over the U.S. called the Worldviews Network, where I worked with scientists and folks that were from various Native American tribes, and as well as delegations from indigenous communities in South America to imagine the ways in which these tools can be used to talk about these modeling processes and these different cosmologies from all of these different perspectives, and not just having, you know, Western scientific rationalism as kind of the overarching view that, you know, trumps everything else, but that it's one more kind of knowledge base, and to really explore how it is we could respectfully explore these different ways of knowing the world and to really try to understand how they can cross-pollinate and inform one another.
You know, absolutely. I mean, that's, I think one of the reasons that people are drawn to indigenous or hermetic Platonic models. I mean, maybe it's not widespread, but there's certainly a lot of modern people who are interested in these things, people who aren't otherwise associated with those worldviews entirely, is because they provide these layers of resonance and connection, not just in terms of the question of modeling, because in a way, to speak kind of critically, a lot of what religion is, and or certainly religious cosmologies, are models. You know, a religion is kind of a model. Well, it might be like this. Now, yeah. Most people are practicing it, don't think of it that way, and that's, you know, raises other questions. But for me, I approach religions in many ways the way I would approach your immersive environment. Well, come on in. Go for the ride. See what happens. try to sense how the questions that are raised and how people are resonating with it in different ways. It doesn't really bother me that much that it's just a model and that other people, quote unquote, really believe it. Like, that's another problem. But there's a more productive and creative way where we look at these as so many models, and that we are pointing towards some place where the models begin to feed back on one another, or they begin to superimpose themselves, but they also splinter. And that's part of what you're showing too, is it's not just that kind of New Age idea that like all the things end up pointing at one big hierarchical model. No, it's that we're trying to navigate through very different worlds, and there's not going to be that integration on either side. You can't escape, you know, the poetic model if you want to, and at the same time you can't just hide from the consequences and the knowledge that's produced through science.
Absolutely, and I think that, you know, the that balance of criticality and enthusiasm can't be emphasized enough, you know, in terms of the significance of how it is we engage this material, and we stay non-attached enough to even explore what these ideas are. I mean, Robert Anton Wilson used to talk about reality tunnels, you know, and I mean, maybe these are a bit like reality spheres that, as in particular, as the interfaces of these head-mounted displays and, you know, so-called virtual reality becomes increasingly commonplace, I think that they're going to start having an effect on the same way that mediation devices affected the modern paradigm. That, you know, it used to be with the linear perspective and the magic lantern and the camera obscura, like all of these different tools really entrain certain ways of thinking in very linear ways. And as we move into this kind of more broad spherical perspective, and people start becoming used to the idea of being in interfaces and putting bubbles over their head so that they can jump around between realities, perhaps this is an opportunity for us to use these tools in such a way that they can really begin to, you know, if not re-entrain, at least begin to loosen up the ways in which we're really conceiving of our ability to fluidly move between these different worldviews, and to really acknowledge and recognize all of those different structures and capabilities that we have within our own consciousness to experience the world through all these different lenses.
No, that's really wonderfully said. You know, it's one thing I've noticed being around the media art scene in the 90s, especially, and into the 2000s. I was always sort of interested in the VR, the immersive, the cosmic, the mystical side of it. You know, that was always part of my beat, but I was spending a lot of time with more critical, you know, intellectual, politicized thinkers and artists, and a lot of them were incredibly hostile to ideas of immersion. And it still is the case. I mean, I think it's the same way that we've been talking about, that not just scientists, but also so-called critical thinkers are often extremely reticent to immerse themselves and to appreciate or affirm immersive experiences, because they see it as somehow threatening, because it's irrational, or it's just ideology. And those are good questions. We have to remember that they're just models. But there's also this kind of resistance, and it feels to me like, I think part of the thing we're going to be looking towards is something like, what is the philosophy or the world views that come out of really robust immersive technologies, where you have to engage the richness of that experience, and at the same time not just, you know, detach and just dive into the new reality tunnel, which I'm afraid many people will do for all sorts of reasons. But at the same time, we have to come up with other ways of understanding the possibilities, the poetry of immersion itself, not just see it as a kind of threat to thinking or a threat to critical consciousness.
Well, this is one of the points that Fuller sort of anticipated in the development and the capabilities that we would have, kind of back to the kind of science losing people after the discovery of the electromagnetic spectrum, that we could begin to visualize, using these tools, a lot of the 99.9% of the, you know, the not only the invisible but the imperceptible realms beyond what we experience with our, you know, so-called unaided senses. And this is really a realm that's been fleshed out by a philosopher named Don Ide in what he calls post-phenomenology. You know, that what happens when we use these tools to really start to imagine things across scales, kind of back to us sitting in our beds as kids, you know, when we're able to look across vast scales of these models of space and time and the electromagnetic spectrum and relationships, and what can that tell us and help us to intuit about the nature of the context of our world. You know, there are so many phenomena, like Timothy Morton talks about these hyperobjects, you know, like how are we thinking about these large scale transformations and how are we even trying to model those? And when we do model them, instead of presenting them as some kind of absolute, how can we actually maintain a metacognitive view, but that we're at least cultivating that aspect of our imagination so that we are able to think across what, you know, Brian Eno calls the big here and the long now. I mean, what is it that we can use these and apply these tools for that can really help to cultivate that capacity much more directly and in a way that isn't so abstract and isn't so theoretical? And I think that's part of the challenge that I have with a lot of the criticality, is that it's become so specialized in terms of written discourse, and that to begin with experience and to mindfully approach the ways of using these immersive tools, it could present ways of us actually finding other ways into cultivating a new kind of criticality by using the tools themselves. And that we right now in particular, we have a need more than ever to think across scales of space and time and about previous generations and future generations. I mean, that these are all sort of cultural, at least within, you know, modern industrial culture and this age of the so-called Anthropocene, that we need to be cultivating these types of practices more than ever, because the degree to which we are active agents in the world has become more apparent than ever.
Right. You know what, David, I think we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks. You know, great conversation, so much more to say, but thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thanks so much, Eric.
That's great. So David McConnell there, McConville, I'll put the link to his talk on the website. Check him out. Next week we'll be talking to science fiction writer, theorist David Gill. Until then, keep your minds open.